Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, a family meeting about sleep. This is part of the kickoff of a WNYC April Sleep Project. Later we'll tell you how to take part in our community data experiment called Clock Your Sleep. Good morning, everyone. Let's get this going with some of your calls. And the first question is simply, what keeps you up at night and how do you fight it? 212-433-WNYC. Let's get some stories on the air as kind of a baseline here to start out. If you have trouble sleeping, what keeps you up at night? And what, if anything, brings on the Z's? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You can help others by calling in and telling your story, even if it doesn't have a clear solution. If you have trouble sleeping, what keeps you up at night? And what, if anything, brings on the Z's as we begin our family meeting on sleep? 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. Call in now. Are there specific things in your life you can't stop thinking about? Is that your issue? 212-433-WNYC. And are you just too wound up sometimes from all the demands of your day-to-day life and you can't decelerate from 60 to zero just like that? Are you trying to do chore, 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 sleep, but it ain't that easy? 212-433-9692. And maybe you get to sleep easily enough, but you wake up way too early. Does that sound like you? Or have you just started popping awake in the middle of the night as you get older and can't get back to sleep and don't even know why? Even though you can get to sleep okay at the beginning of the night, 212-433-WNYC. At what age did you start having trouble with sleep, if this is something that has come on you over time? And if you have trouble sleeping, call in and tell us. What keeps you up at night? And what, if anything, brings on the Z's? 212-433-9692. And we'll start with Jimmy in Bayville. Jimmy, thanks for calling and starting us off. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay. Did you sleep last night?
I have many sleepless nights, and I have a habit, and I don't know why I do this, but my brain has become wired to, as soon as I have enough consciousness, that it goes to things I worry about, points of stress. I'm a small business owner, and there's a lot of stress in it, and I try and fight it, but usually I toss and turn and just give in and go make a pot of coffee.
And this is one of the things that we'll talk about when we bring on some guests in a few minutes, is how do we get our minds off those stress points? Because I think your story is so common, Jimmy. People who are worrying about their business, people who are worrying about their family, things like that. And we go right there in the middle of the night so often, instead of going to what movie you just saw that you really liked. Wasn't that final episode of How I Met Your Mother really great?
It's amazing. And I try and fight it. And I never used to be like that. I used to sleep like a log. My wife used to get mad at me because the kids would be crying, and I would not wake up. And now I'm up three times a night, and she gets mad at me because I get up.
What does work for you when it works? Anything?
What does work for me? Exhaustion.
Uh-huh.
So, exhaustion, really. I try and fight it. I've read things. Write it down. Write down your worries on a pad by your nightstand. Think of good thoughts. Sometimes I find that maybe I'll be able to go back to sleep, but majority of the time I find myself just over worrying and just stress points that. And I get mad at myself because it's an amazing thing that trigger happens as soon as my consciousness is aware of the fact that I'm awake, and boom, it's like a vacuum straight to that point.
Right, and that awareness that you're awake doesn't help. It's the try to relax paradox. Oh, I'm aware that I'm awake. I'm aware that I'm not sleeping. I'm aware that I have to try to sleep. And then you try to sleep, and then you're trying not to try. And a lot of people get stuck there. Jimmy, thanks for starting us off. I really appreciate it. I'm sure a lot of people relate to exactly the way you described your situation. Exhaustion is an interesting element here because for some people, yeah, you are sleepless for a few nights, and then you're so tired, you just sleep. You'd think that would be the natural cycle, but it doesn't work that way. Usually for Jimmy, it sounds like, and it doesn't work that way for a lot of people. So when we get some guests coming on in a little while, we'll put all of that out there. 212-433-WNYC. If you have trouble sleeping, what keeps you up at night and what, if anything, brings on the Z's? Britta in Hell's Kitchen, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Britta.
Good morning. Good morning.
Did you sleep last night?
Actually, I slept better than I had been sleeping. I was up for about an hour, but I usually wake up because I have so much on my mind that, you know, I'm a creative person and I'm either writing something or working on a deadline. And so last night, yesterday morning, I finished the deadline, so I knew I could sleep if I was able to. But I woke up between 2 and 3:30. And at that point, I knew I could tell myself to relax, but I wasn't able to go back to sleep. So I got up and had some warm milk and just read, you know, The New Yorker or something. And then I was able to go back to sleep, and I actually slept in until, like, 5 after 6.
Five after six? That's sleeping in?
Yeah. When I can get a full night, I usually am up at 4 or 5, and that is typically good. I tend to go to sleep pretty early, 9 p.m. But when I'm, you know, really fully into something, it's just my ideas that wake me up. And usually I have something important to write down, so I'll just get up and work for a while.
And am I right listening to you that, unlike Jimmy, it's not always what's stressing you out? It's sometimes your own euphoria, is that too strong a word, over the ideas that you're having for your creative work?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, it has stressed me out. I think I got into this habit when I was in graduate school and teaching a freshman writing class that I wasn't actually that prepared for. So I'd get up and really, you know, jam on the preparations and then try to get some sleep before I had to go to class.
Right. And you know what a lot of creative people do is keep a pad by the side of the bed. If you have an idea, write it down, so you can then put it on that little paper bubble and dismiss it.
Yeah, but then I still can't get back to sleep. So yeah. I've found over the years that it's just easier to get up and do some work for an hour or two and then go back to sleep.
Right. You talked about reading The New Yorker last night. Does reading work for you a lot? And are there certain things to read or not to read in your case?
Yeah, I have to read something completely different than something I'm working on because my mental energy just gets too wound up.
That makes sense. And not too something not too interesting, or does that matter?
Just it can't be on the electronic device. It has to be in paper form because I know that that's going to affect my eyeballs, that blue light. You know,
right.
I've read that. So
yeah. And
that
we'll talk about we'll talk about the science of the blue light with our guest coming up. Britta, thank you very much. Good luck out there. Maybe we'll get you some answers. Ilya in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Ilya.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How'd you sleep last night?
Last night was pretty average. I go to sleep somewhere after midnight and wake up in time to get kids to school. I only woke up once or twice yesterday, though. That was good. But I am my own worst sleep enemy. That's my confession of the day, if I'm going to be real. So I can't help but waking up in the middle of the night and what my mind does, and I won't repeat what other listeners have said. I agree that reading in paper is great, but I need to get myself in bed earlier. There's always one more thing to do, and I am worse than my children when it comes to procrastinating about just getting into bed.
How many hours do you think you need to feel good when you wake up?
I haven't slept more than 6 or 7 hours in probably over a decade, maybe once or twice. So I don't know, but they say 8 hours. I'd like to try that at some point. But there's so much to do and enjoy and experience and read that
You want to live. You don't want to sleep.
For me, it's more often that than it is stress, although, of course, that plays a role as well. I saw something on, I think it was House of Cards. There was this great quote where it was a quote that was about, you know, man's weakness is that we actually have to lie down at some point. And that's frustrating for me.
Absolutely. For me, too. We'll talk about that with our next guest, too. But when you get the 6 or 7 hours of sleep that you get, it sounds from what you're saying that you don't actually feel too bad because there's just so much you want to do. So do you have negative repercussions from not getting as much sleep as you might want?
Yeah, if I'm under like 6.5 hours, my memory suffers terribly, and it's my short-term memory. I've been known to like store pens in the refrigerator and not know where I put them and things like that. I can't seem to hold onto thoughts, which is obviously challenging at work. I'd say my short-term memory and then also my workouts, which are important to me and my performance elsewhere, they suffer obviously if I haven't had enough sleep. And I think it goes on and on. I definitely need more sleep.
Ilya, good luck tonight, every night, during the day. Thank you for calling us. Karen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Sleep last night?
I slept okay. I slept, I usually go to bed pretty late. I go to bed after my husband does because I work from home. I can't go to sleep without Ambien. I used to take the other kind of sleep remedy, not the Tylenol PM, but the other one. If I don't take it, I don't sleep, and I feel it because my PTSD kicks in a little bit at night if I'm trying to go to sleep and I can't fall asleep. I'll just have flashbacks of stuff that happened to me in high school and junior high, and even though it was a long time ago, mm-hmm. I'll just kind of relive certain memories, mm-hmm. and it'll just happen. Forget about stress or whatever that's going on during now. It just kind of comes in. And I'm sure like other guests have said or will say, you know, people just tell you to just push those memories away. It's very hard. Something you can't really just do. And to me, Ambien, it just kind of helps you sleep. And to me, it is kind of medication in a sense for PTSD. And I guess I would tell people Ambien works so well that, I mean, if you haven't taken it yet, you shouldn't because you'll want to use it a lot. But I kind of have a love-hate relationship with Ambien because if I don't take it, I don't sleep.
What's the hate part if it works for you?
Well, the hate part is that I have to take it.
Oh, did we lose you?
No, I'm right here.
Go ahead, Karen.
Well, the hate part is that I have to take that if I don't take it, I don't sleep.
Uh-huh. So it's not particular side effects or even worry about long-term side effects. It's just that psychological letting yourself down by being dependent on an external substance?
I don't really know too much about the long-term side effects. I know it's a fairly new drug. My doctor's given it to me. He knows how much I take. I've never raised my dosage in the few years that I've taken it, and he's never batted an eyelash about it. I don't know a lot about the long-term side effects. I know there's a difference between addiction and dependency, and Ambien is dependency.
You don't like that you need it.
Yeah, but I mean, it works. So I take it because it works, and it helps with, you know, it helps you sleep if you're being kept up at night because of bad, stressful thoughts.
Right.
It helps you go to sleep.
Karen, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much. And we're going to ask a doctor who's coming on in a little while about Ambien and other sleep medications. Are there long-term dangers that either have or have not been studied but need to be studied because they haven't been ruled out? Or why not take medication if, like Karen, it helps you sleep on a regular basis? Sarah in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Did you sleep last night?
Well, I wanted to talk about, I have chronic daily migraines, and they started around the same time as my insomnia. My insomnia mostly manifests in like the 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. wake up time.
Uh-huh.
And during trying to figure out, you know, going to lots of doctors and trying to work on my migraine stuff, I tried this vitamin called phosphatidylserine, and it is supposed to be a cortisol regulator, and it's really helped quite a bit, and so I wanted to call in and kind of share that. Because I guess supposedly...
So it's a supplement that you can buy over the counter at a health food store or a drugstore?
Yeah, exactly. It's supposed to be, it's just like, I mean, it's silly, but it's for brain health. That's what it says, you know, on the bottle or whatever.
But you're finding it helps you sleep, so whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So, supposedly there's a cortisol spike around 4 a.m. and around 11 a.m., and that is sometimes what jolts people awake around that time at night.
Phosphatidyl.
And so it's supposed to... Yeah, I can
say it again. Say the whole name of it, just in case people.
Phosphatidylserine, phosphatidyl, and then serine, serine.
Sarah, thank you very much. And when our first guest comes on in just a few minutes to talk about the science of sleep, we'll ask about that. 4 a.m. and 11 a.m. spike, is that really true? Is there such a thing as a biological clock that's independent of us as human beings or our activities or when we work? Anthony in Clifton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I heard your guest yesterday talking, and it described me exactly about how I don't have a problem getting this, you know, going to sleep initially, but I wake up in the middle of the night, as probably most men my age do, and go to the bathroom, and then it's, boom, the switch is on and my brain starts going, and to get back to sleep is real difficult. And, you know, the thing is, if I don't fall asleep and get like another 45 minutes to a half hour, I'm wrecked, like today.
You'd wreck right now because you couldn't get back to sleep last night.
Yeah, I didn't get that last, I mean, I'm not sleeping a full 8 hours, but sometimes if I can just get that last cycle out properly and get a last, you know, rest where I wake up on my own, even if it's a half hour, I feel refreshed. But yeah, you know, as I was telling your producer, I used to sleep a lot better before I had kids and a mortgage. You know, I'm up at the littlest sound in the house.
Because you're thinking about the house and you're thinking about the kids and you just have more on your mind than when you were young and single.
I think so. I think things used to be a lot simpler and you used to have a restful sleep. But I just wanted to tell a quick story. I remember when I was about 12 years old and I went to my neighbor, I was over at my neighbor's house and his father was always sleeping. He had a lazy boy and in the middle of the day he'd be sleeping. And I asked him one time either him or my friend, and he was like, yeah, my dad only sleeps 5 hours a night. And I was like horrified by that. And now as someone who's that age or nearing that age, I'm doing the exact same thing. I think, you know, it's just amazing how you just fall right into the pattern based on all the, as life changes.
What works for you when it does work? Anything in particular or just trying to avoid getting your brain engaged when you wake up to go to the bathroom?
I'm trying to, you know, I stay in bed. I don't want to get up and fight it and play that game. I stay in bed and I just keep trying to clear my mind and just work on clearing my mind. And eventually, sometimes it takes a half hour, sometimes it takes an hour and a half. Hopefully it eventually works. And most times it does. But it's definitely not going to bed and sleeping through the night and getting 7 hours or 8 hours like it used to be.
Anthony, thank you for your call. Carolita writes on our webpage, if I think about anything with numbers, dates, deadlines, money, debt, computer problems at night, I will not sleep. So those subjects are totally forbidden when speaking to me anytime when I'm winding down to go to bed. If I get to bed and find I have a little trouble falling asleep, the thing that works every time, and she puts every time in caps, try to imagine the outfit I'm going to wear in the morning. Carolita writes, the most boring thought ever, since I pretty much wear the same thing to work every day. So it works. I always fall asleep before I decide on the whole outfit. So there's a little baseline, folks. What helps? What helps you sleep? And if you have trouble sleeping, what keeps you up at night? Before you find that solution to bring on the Z's or not, let's bring on some guests and talk more about it. Thank you. It's our family meeting on sleep on the Brian Lehrer Show. We're talking about sleep all morning today as part of WNYC's Clock Your Sleep Project. Go to WNYC.org to start keeping a sleep journal with the rest of us. And we just heard that lots of people struggle with sleep. Now let's get into some of the science of this. What is sleep anyway? Why does it matter for quality of life or long-term health? What scientifically impedes sleep? Joining us for this is Dr. Carl Bazile, Director of the Division of Epilepsy and Sleep at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. He's been advising WNYC on our new Clock Your Sleep project. Welcome back to WNYC, Dr. Bazile.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And listeners, ask a sleep scientist. The phones are open, so we're going to clear the lines of people calling for the previous segment with just what keeps you up. Ask a sleep scientist anything about how sleep and sleeplessness work. 212-433-WNYC. So what is sleep anyway? Because honestly, Dr. Bazile, I get angry at having to sleep. If you sleep well, you're giving up a third of your life to not doing anything. And honestly, I'd rather not have to sleep, or rather not have to choose between sleeping and feeling like hell if I don't sleep. So what is sleep really?
Well, there's no simple answer to that, but it is something that your body needs for lots of reasons, and I'm sure we'll get into that. It seems like a waste of time because we can overcome it, and that's what I've heard from a lot of the people that call in. That's a natural thing. In fact, it's a protective thing that your body can overcome that need to sleep if it really needs to. The problem is it sometimes does that when it doesn't really need to.
Is there a difference between sleep and being unconscious, or sleep and being in a coma, or sleep and being under general anesthesia?
There absolutely is. Your brain, when you're asleep, is actually very active, and this is one of the big areas of research in sleep medicine. We're trying to understand what exactly is happening in that very active brain. Whereas if you look at someone who is anesthetized, their brain patterns are very, very different, so it's definitely not the same thing.
Different how? Do you know?
Well, there are structures that we see in the electrophysiology of the brain during sleep that are very stereotyped. Now, we don't know what a lot of them mean, but there are lots of different frequencies, lots of buzzes, activity that we see in different stages of sleep. If someone is deeply anesthetized, there's very little activity going on.
I think people want to know, how much sleep am I supposed to get? So what's the answer? And is that even the right question?
Well, it's not a simple thing to answer, but the ballpark figure that most people believe is correct is between 7 and 8 hours for an adult. It varies somewhat according to age. It doesn't really drop as you get older, but one of the more concerning areas is teenagers who actually need more than that, and they're probably a group that is getting, if anything, less than the adults right now.
How do you know you're not getting enough sleep? Is it just the obvious answer, you feel tired?
Well, that's your first signal. If you are falling asleep very easily, especially in places where you shouldn't, like if you sit down for a moment and start to read, you immediately fall asleep, that's a signal. If you're very, very sleep deprived, you may even fall asleep doing things like talking to somebody, or most frighteningly, while you're driving, if you're stopped at a light, or even if you're on a long, boring stretch of highway. Now, that's really terrifying, but that's the kind of signal that your body is telling you you're not getting enough sleep.
Your calls for Dr. Carl Bazile on the science of sleep, 212-433-WNYC. And Ina in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Dina.
Dina, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I have a question about sleep talking. My husband is a sleep talker. It started about 2 or 3 years ago, and it really affects my sleep. And even using a sleep tracker, I noticed that I sleep pretty well until the time he comes to bed, and then I'm up periodically during the night with his sleep talking. And then on the nights that he's not talking, I find that I'm waking up anyway in the middle of the night around those same times. And I'm kind of wondering if I'm also being trained to wake up in the middle of the night when there's not the interruption.
I think that's probably true. Obviously, sleep talking isn't really a problem for him. It's
right.
Not common in adults. It's very common in children. But what's happening to you is it's becoming a signal that wakes you up, and that's obvious. You hear something, it's your husband, and your brain can wake you up from that. But like many triggers for potential insomnia, that can become ingrained. So how you get over it, now that's a more complicated question. It also depends on how much of a problem it is. It sounds like it is becoming a problem for you, though.
It can be up to 5 nights a week.
Now, do you have trouble, like, you hear him and you wake up and you stay awake, or is it just that you feel like your sleep is very disturbed?
I feel like my sleep is very disturbed. I do wake up from it. Often I can fall back to sleep. Sometimes I can't, depending on what time of the night it is. But often I am able to fall back to sleep. But I find that it'll happen multiple times during the night, and I just feel interrupted.
Sure. Well, one of the things I like to start with in that sort of scenario is to recommend relaxation techniques, and that may sound very simplistic. It may not be enough, but things that you can do before you go to sleep that are variations on meditation or even self-hypnosis that might help you to get past that. I mean, there are other treatments. I wouldn't want to jump to medicine for something like that, but, you know, behavioral treatments can often help.
Thank you, Ina. Good luck. Are we worse at sleeping in New York City, you know, the city that never sleeps? Is sleep cultural?
I think it absolutely is, and there's lots of evidence of that. In New York, you know, what one of the things that we keep alluding to is your body will respond to stimulus. Well, a place like New York that literally doesn't sleep, there's things going on all night, things that you may want to do, going out to clubs, some people are into that, working late at night, that's very prevalent here. But there's also, you know, noise stimulus. There's ambulances, there's, you know, noisy neighbors. There's lots of things that wake us up more here than if we were living on a farm in Iowa.
So Lark in Bergen County has a question. Hi, Lark.
Hi. My question is regarding, like, CPAP machines and sleep apnea. Probably 6 or 7 years ago, I was diagnosed after my husband heard me snoring considerably louder and louder and then stopping, you know, breathing. So I went and had a test more recently in January, and I actually was notified of your program because my husband texted me and said, you need to put NPR on. This is part of your problem mm-hmm. that's going on. And in January, I started having panic attacks between 3:30 and 4:30 every morning. Just sort of out of the blue, didn't know why it was happening. I've been, you know, blood tested a million times. I'm wondering now, you know, is it something to do with my sleep? Maybe the reactions that I'm having, the feelings that I'm getting are somehow, you know, a change in my sleep pattern, and I haven't picked that up. How often should CPAP machine testing be done? Is there something else I can do beyond that?
Thank you, Lark. And what is sleep apnea, actually, Dr. Bazile?
Sleep apnea is a very important sleep disorder, and it's good that you actually got checked out because lots of people don't. They go on with those same signals for years or even decades. In other words, loud snoring, interrupted sleep, breathing problems in their sleep, and they never get checked out. But not only does it disturb your sleep and make you sleepy the next day, but it's a significant risk factor both for stroke and heart disease. So it's a very important sleep disorder. What happens is, you know, basically as your body relaxes into sleep, which is normal, your throat becomes more and more narrow. And that may just result in snoring because air is being forced through a narrow airway. But if it relaxes more, it actually cuts off your breathing and interrupts your sleep over and over all night. Back to your question, though, what could be the problem? Well, I think you're right. The first question is there something wrong with the machine? Because it could be if at some point in the night you're not getting air, that signal of waking up in a panic happens in people with untreated sleep apnea. So that would be the first thing I would check out, is to make sure that the mask isn't leaking, that there isn't a problem with the machine, and you should talk to the prescriber about that. It's possible that there's something else going on. I mean, you can wake up in a panic from other problems, but that would be the first thing that I would look into.
Lark, good luck. Let's talk more about what happens to our bodies if we don't sleep enough. You pointed us to a study that found you have 3 times the risk of contracting a cold if you sleep fewer than 7 hours a night compared with those who slept at least 8 hours a night. So your entire immune system is compromised with one fewer hour?
Well, that was habitual. And that's another theme in sleep medicine. You know, most people won't have a problem if they're well-rested and then they have one poor night of sleep. But we're talking about chronic sleep deprivation, and that's one of the things that really seems to affect your immune system. And yes, we believe that less than 7 hours isn't enough for most people, and that experiment, that study is one of the lines of evidence. that your immune system doesn't work as well. You don't fight off a cold as well.
When you say 7 hours, do you mean straight, or if you sleep 2 hours here, an hour and a half there, and you wind up with 7 hours, is that the equivalent?
Well, actually, at least from a historical standpoint, it seems to be normal for humans to sleep in two blocks, which I think is kind of fascinating. Hundreds of years ago, when there was no electric lights, people used to go to sleep at sundown. And in most places in the world, except summer, you know, you'd have about 12 hours. Well, you weren't going to sleep for 12 hours. You would sleep for four, then get up, do some things, and then go back to sleep. So that's not necessarily abnormal at all. And we think the total amount is really what's important. The problem is if you get very interrupted sleep, then that can develop into a problem where you have more and more trouble getting back to sleep.
There's another study you pointed us to that suggests that vaccines might not work as well on a person who isn't getting enough sleep. Explain that. It was a hepatitis B vaccine study, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, another very interesting study. What they did is they looked at people who were getting that vaccine, which hopefully everyone is now, and they looked at the antibody titers, which is a measure of how protected they are against that that virus. And what they found is if you were sleeping less, again, I believe it was in the order of less than 7 hours, you had less chance of getting fully protected. Most people who got a full night's sleep over 8 hours, virtually 100% got the correct response, enough to prevent infection. But about 20 or 25% of the people who didn't sleep more than 7 hours a night didn't get protected.
So a weakened immune system is one big health risk correlated to poor sleep. What are some other long-term chronic health issues that are correlated? For example, the links between poor sleep and diabetes, I have read, is real. Obesity, heart disease, cardiovascular issues, mood and mental health issues like depression and anxiety. There's such a list you could find in the literature. I even read that there's some evidence that sleep is correlated to cancer. Is that a real thing?
Well, I was actually going to start with cancer, and I think that relates to the evidence for immune dysfunction, because it may be that your immune system is one of the ways that you prevent against cancer. Those studies, you know, they're harder to do because, you know, finding people sleep habits over a long time and who develops cancer is more difficult than just giving somebody a cold and seeing if they get infected or not. But there are lots of lines of evidence. You mentioned depression and anxiety. There's no question that's involved with sleep and sleep deprivation. And not only involved, it's completely linked. You can't treat depression without treating sleep disorders and vice versa. Heart disease, one of the more important sleep problems related to that I mentioned before is sleep apnea. That's a more concrete one. But if you look at simple sleep deprivation, there are links, but it's not clear how exactly that happens.
We'll continue in a minute with the science of sleep and Dr. Carl Bazile and more of your questions on the science of sleep. It's our family meeting on sleep here on the Brian Lehrer Show today, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And just the beginning of our month-long April sleep project stationwide at WNYC. Go to wnyc.org/sleep for all kinds of sleep stories and information.
Fear of sleep. Fear of sleep. Fear of sleep. Fear of sleep. Fear of sleep.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about sleep. All show today as part of WNYC's Clock Your Sleep project. Go to WNYC.org to start keeping a sleep journal with many of the rest of us, with the Count Your Sleep app that we'll tell you about in a little more detail in a little while. Right now, we're talking about the science of sleep with Dr. Carl Bazile, Director of the Division of Epilepsy and Sleep at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. And we'll take more of your science of sleep questions in just a minute. That song by The Strokes, Fear of Sleep. Actually, there are people, we had a caller earlier with PTSD, and she was afraid of the nightmares that she would have when she fell asleep. And so that could even be a real thing, fear of sleep, that keeps people from sleeping?
It can be. That's a minority of the sleeping problems that I see. But you know, just imagine if you had been awakened in some sort of a horrible situation, like, you know, bombs going off in a war situation or something like that, you could easily develop an anxiety reaction to going to sleep. But, you know, maybe the corollary for the rest of us is, you know, maybe you're worried about going to sleep because you're afraid you won't wake up in time for that important meeting, or you're afraid you'll forget this, you know, inspiration that you're having just as you're falling asleep. You know, so on a lesser scale, that can contribute to insomnia on a number of levels.
Greg in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Brian. First time caller, long time listener.
Thanks
for having me.
Thanks for joining.
Sure. I have a question about a concept that Buckminster Fuller talked about in the 60s called Dymaxian sleep, where you slept more frequently for less amounts of time. I find when I'm under deadlines, I'm an artist, that I adapt to like a 6-hour sleep cycle in which I have like 2 to 4 hours of sleep, and it's like twice a day. And I'm wondering how that affects our body and our mind, and is that natural in any way for humans to do that, and is in long term, is it healthy?
Well, I probably have somebody at least once a week who says, well, I want to get used to sleeping 6 or 5 hours per night, and I'm sure I can do it, just like, you know, if you exercise, your butt muscles get bigger. Well, it doesn't really seem to work that way.
Right.
There are different sleep schedules that your body can adapt to, however, and it sounds like that's what you're doing. You can get by with, you know, sleeping in different amounts and at different times.
Right.
Some places in the world, you know, they do sleep, you know, maybe 6 hours at night, but then take a 2-hour siesta during the day. And that's perfectly fine for your body as far as anything we can see. You know, what worries me a little bit if you're spending long periods of time getting only 6 hours total. And we think that could end up causing problems.
Greg, thank you. Can you catch up on sleep? People say that all the time, right? This weekend I'm going to catch up on sleep. So if you sleep 5 hours during the week, but 9 or 10 on the weekends, are you good?
That's a really important concept. I kind of mentioned before that most people can get by okay if they're well-rested and then have one short night of sleep. And you will make up for that relatively quickly. What we see from another number of lines of evidence is the sleep loss is cumulative. In other words, you develop something called a sleep debt. So if you start on Sunday night by only getting 5 hours of sleep and you do that all week, by the time you get to Friday night, you're 15 hours behind in what we think is the total sleep requirement. You can make that up, but you probably won't unless you sleep all weekend.
Mike in Pauling, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. And I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a question for your guest. I recently purchased an app for my phone. I won't give you the name of it. I don't want to mark it for them. However,
if you like it, it's very
helpful. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm saying you can Yelp here, meaning if you like it, you can tell us. If you don't like the app, you can tell us that too.
Okay, I love it. I suffer from tinnitus, and that has kept me awake. I usually have chimes hanging around my house, so that kind of breaks up the background noise. Or I go, going to sleep with earbuds in my ear with some music. But this app allows, it's called Brainwave, and it's supposed to induce, for example, it has a dreamy sleep option that allows you to induce a complex sequence of delta and theta frequencies designed to induce sleep combined with vivid dreams. And I'm using this, and it's really improved my sleep dramatically. And you can also have a background noise of ocean waves, and you can adjust the sound that this makes. It kind of gives a humming sound in your ear. Now, it seems to be working for me. Now, my question is...
Now, by now, people really want to know... Have you purchased a placebo? But now, now, people really want to know the name of the app. So what is it?
Oh, didn't I say it? I thought I did. It's called Brainwave.
You did say it. I'm sorry.
It's called Brainwave. And you can grab lucid dreaming, which is really great. I went to a workshop on lucid dreaming many years ago, and my son and I both practiced it until we found that it was keeping us awake.
Mike, hang on a second. If he's purchased a placebo, don't tell him.
Well,
because it'll blow the whole thing.
Well,
that's true.
And placebos do work in sleep, as in a lot of conditions, but I don't think this is really a placebo. What it's doing is it's giving you an external stimulus. In this case, you know, it may be waves, it may be music. I didn't hear all the different things it potentially can do, but that becomes a signal for your brain to shut down. And that's really what a lot of the behavioral treatments for sleep do. Everybody's different. And, you know, there are things, you know, if some people hear crashing waves, that's going to induce anxiety and they won't go to sleep. Many people, it's relaxing. But this is giving you different signals to help you relax, and I think that does work. The brainwave thing, I have to say, I'm a little skeptical about.
Because?
Well, there's no evidence that you can use certain stimuli like that to produce delta sleep, for instance, which is seems like it was trying to tell you. But it can certainly help you get to sleep.
Thank you for your call, Mike. I'm glad there's something that's working for you. So there's the kind of noise that can put you to sleep, and then there's the kind of noise we use to wake ourselves up. Here's the classic alarm clock. So is that the most annoying sound or what? And is there any merit to this idea that instead of setting that annoying sound to wake you up at a specific time, that instead there is a perfect moment to wake up according to your sleep cycles?
Well, a lot of the apps claim to do that, and most of them are associated with motion detectors, accelerometers. So what I think they do is they look for when you're in lighter sleep, which you might be able to do with those sort of devices. I think that's entirely possible, depending on exactly how they work. So then when you wake up, you're not quite as groggy, whereas if it wakes you up during deep sleep, it's harder to get up.
So you give the app, as I understand it, a window of time in which you need to wake up, and it can sense when you're in your lightest level of sleep and wakes you up then, instead of ripping you violently out of a deep sleep, even if that's a half hour, 45 minutes later than the earlier wake-up time might be.
Exactly. And if you want to get more skeptical about it, what it's actually doing is sensing when you're already awake anyway and then making you stay awake.
But is that real science?
Well, I think there's a science to it. That technology has been used in sleep medicine for years. It's called actigraphy, where you use motion as sort of a surrogate for sleep. It's not perfect, but it will give you a pretty good idea of whether you're deeply asleep or not.
For some of the callers we had before you came on, someone talked about natural cycles that tend to boost your awakeness at about 4 a.m. and 11 a.m. Real science?
Yes. That is part of a normal circadian rhythm. And I don't know about those precise times, but I mentioned before that people used to sleep in blocks. There seems to be a natural arousal period mid-sleep, which for most people would be maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, where you tend to wake up. Most people would just go back to sleep. The more obvious phenomenon that most people know about is a time of relative drowsiness, usually just after lunchtime, which is siesta time. It's there because that's part of your natural sleep cycle.
Talk about screens and the effect of that blue light.
Yeah, I think that's a little controversial. I can start with the real science, something that I recommend very frequently, which are the commercial light boxes. Those deliver a strong blue light, which is meant to signal your body it's time to be awake. And, you know, that works through melatonin, basically. Controversy about screens is that they use those same frequencies. So is it possible that that's delivering a stimulus that will interrupt your melatonin and keep you awake at night? Absolutely. I think that for most people, though, especially if you set your screen on the dimmer settings at night, it's probably not going to be a huge problem. The bigger problem is you're staying active on your computer, you're working, you're stimulating your brain in other ways other than light, and that can definitely keep you up.
Tommy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tommy.
Hi, Lou. How are you?
Okay.
I have a question. For the past 10 years, now I have problems sleeping, and I've been taking 250 milligram tablets of the sleep gels, the over-the-counter sleep gels, and 10 milligrams of melatonin and 2 or 3 milligrams of Xanax. And I sleep well. I get up and I go to the gym and I go to work and I do what I have to do. I'm wondering if it has going to have any effect on my liver or kidney or anything else.
Well, it depends on what those are. I can start with the you said you're taking Xanax. You know, what happens with that medicine in particular, medicines like it over time, is you tend to develop tolerance. So it may not really be having much of an effect anymore, although it's part of your signal to sleep. So, and if you stop it, then you may have withdrawal symptoms. So that's a problem that you'd have to work on getting off of. Melatonin, we think, is pretty benign. What was the dose you said you took, or do you know?
Your dose of melatonin, Tommy?
10 milligrams.
10 milligrams. Yeah, that's not a huge dose. It's enough to make people drowsy, and it is a naturally occurring hormone. The gel, I don't know what's in that particular one. Most of them have an antihistamine, diphenhyramine, and that can help to make you drowsy. I don't know exactly what's in the gel that you're taking. They may have a number of things. Most of them are probably going to be benign, though.
Side effects of Ambien, somebody asked earlier, or anything else? Are there long-term reasons not to take substances if they help you sleep?
Well, ideally, I believe that medications, whether they're prescription or herbal or whatever, they're helping to retrain your brain to sleep correctly. So the best way to use something like Ambien is, you know, it may help you in the short term, get you to sleep on a regular basis. You may need to do that for several months, but then you want to try to get off of them. On the other hand, I have people that have been taking these medicines.
But why? Why do you want to try to get off of them? I mean, ideally, it's nice to, you know, not have any external help. But what if it just works and it's hard to get off? Somebody called about dependency as opposed to addiction on a sleep medication. Why do you have to wean yourself?
Well, I was kind of getting to that. If you can't, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world. Ambien is a pretty benign medicine when taken as directed. It doesn't seem to cause dependency, especially in lower doses. And it hasn't been studied for years and years at a time. That's the hesitation. We don't know definitely that there aren't any long-term effects. Although, you know, so many people take that and have been doing it for so long, I think it's unlikely that there are common long-term effects.
Last question. Why do we dream?
Oh, that's the really most unknown area of sleep medicine and perhaps the most interesting. The theories of that is that you're experiencing some sort of shuffling of information during dreams. And you know, when you remember them, most of them seem like nonsense. They may have bits and pieces of what has happened during the day. Some of them have sort of weird plot-like things.
But, or that reflect your hopes or anxieties.
Well, it may. I think there probably is some truth to that. You know, psychiatrists have used dreams for millennia to try to figure out what is going on in people's minds that they're not aware of. So I think there is some truth to the sorting through of things during REM sleep, which is when most of those dreams happen. But exactly what that does in terms of your health, we don't know.
Dr. Carl Bazile, Director of the Division of Epilepsy and Sleep at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. He's been advising WNYC on our new Clock Your Sleep project. Thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Thanks for doing this project. I think it's great.
WNYC with our family meeting on sleep today. And now a deeper dive on what to do about your insomnia. Our next guest is Shelby Harris, the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at Montefiore Medical Center and an advisor to WNYC's Clock Your Sleep Project. Dr. Harris, welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So listeners, if you struggled with insomnia or have had trouble staying asleep through the night in the past, but figured out what helps you sleep, give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. And if you want the benefit of Dr. Harris's expertise, call in with your questions. Your questions welcome here, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. So Dr. Harris, you specialize, as I said, in cognitive behavioral therapy to help people sleep. What is that exactly and how does it work?
Okay. So CBT, or cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, we call it CBTI, is really considered in the sleep field the gold standard treatment for insomnia right now. Problem is, there aren't a lot of people who are specially trained in it. So when we think about CBTI, it's really the cognitive part and the behavioral part. So a lot of people who have insomnia, what happens over time is that they start to change behaviors that they normally would do before they ever had sleep problems. So people might start going to bed earlier or sleep in the morning or sleep in on the weekends, napping, trying to catch sleep whenever they can. They also start to lay in bed longer amounts of time. They might watch TV in bed or start to try and force sleep to happen, have more caffeine. So we really try to change the behaviors that they're doing that are getting in the way of their sleep, as well as worries about sleep. So people start to worry, I won't be able to function tomorrow, and they get very anxious at night. So it's a very short-term treatment for most people, 4 to 12 sessions, of changing the behaviors and the thoughts about sleep. And it's just as effective as medications in the short term.
Give me an example of how you try to eliminate people's worry about not being able to sleep, because it's such a self-reinforcing cycle. You don't get enough sleep. you don't get enough sleep again, you think it's a chronic problem for you, so then you worry about not being able to get enough sleep, and that in itself
right.
keeps you up, but it's a legitimate worry. So how do you just tell yourself, try not to try?
Right. So what we notice is when people, I think the fact that we're doing all this sleep diary data and tracking your sleep is really helpful. What we notice for many people is that if you go one night of really bad sleep or even no sleep for some people, which is pretty unusual, usually by the second night and usually even more so by the third night, you tend to get more sleep. So I usually have patients kind of repeat a mantra to themselves that if I don't sleep tonight, I'll sleep better tomorrow. And if not, then by the third. And sometimes knowing that you can't control the sleep and kind of giving it up to your body and your body will sleep with the behavioral changes you make can kind of let the pressure go a little bit and the worry.
So that's the cognitive part.
Exactly.
Understanding that.
Understanding that you can't always make yourself go to sleep even though you want to.
And then what's the behavioral part?
So the behavioral part that I see most often is patients with insomnia, they tend to spend too much time in bed awake. So they're laying there 8 hours in bed, but they're only sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night. So what we actually do is we limit them, within reason, to a certain amount of hours that they're sleeping at night. We usually don't do less than 4 or 5 hours, but you're laying in bed 8 hours. You're 3 hours of the night, you're laying there tossing and turning. So I'd rather people go to bed later but get up at the same time every day. And when they start falling asleep faster and staying asleep more, then we slowly increase the time in bed that they're allowed. And that works very well for a number of insomnia patients.
And so if you're going to let yourself off the hook from worrying about sleep, mm-hmm. it means you just have to kind of have a more relaxed attitude about how crappy you feel during the day after you haven't gotten enough sleep?
That's a really good point. You know, you have to be realistic about it. So patients, I often think that at 3, 4 in the morning, I know for myself, the rational side of our brain is not always taking over. So we wake up and we often think to ourselves, how am I going to get through tomorrow? I'm not going to be able to function. I won't be able to do anything. But if you really work with someone or you think about it yourself, you think realistically. So maybe you won't be at 100% functioning level, but maybe 70% of you, maybe you'll get through work. You might not do as great as normal, but the catastrophizing part probably isn't going to be there. So if you can get through that part, it will help you function the next day.
Glenn in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC, Brian Lehrer Show Family Meeting on Sleep. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Brian. Big fan, been listening for years.
Thank you.
I am a chronic insomniac, and one of the tricks that I've used that sometimes works to help me get to sleep is to count back from 100 or even 200 if it's not working by 7.
I think that's a great technique that you use. There's something that we like to think of as cognitive distraction. I think that's a really good technique of cognitive distraction. And sometimes patients find that just counting by numbers, like 99, 98, is not distracting enough that actually I have some patients count backwards by 3s or by 7s, and they find that that can help even more. But if you have a constant thought loop in your head before you go to bed at night, doing something like the numbers or visual imagery can actually be really helpful to get in the way of the thoughts.
So this is the most stereotypical, classic sleep aid mm-hmm. that you could think of. This is like counting sheep.
Exactly. And there is a lot of benefit to counting sheep. Just some people find it's very silly and they do something else.
So something repetitive like that to kind of lull yourself to sleep. Does the rhythm kind of matter?
You know, I think the rhythm can be beneficial because it can, like you said, lull yourself to sleep. But what I like is something that's focused that has movement to it. So counting sheep, you're counting and you're picturing them going over, you know, the fence. Counting backwards, there's movement to it. So you're having some sort of focused imagery or thought process.
Joan in Manhasset. You're on WNYC. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I go to sleep very quickly, sleep very deeply. I read before I go to bed. I don't have television in the room. I'm exercising, all the good things I do, you know. Then I wake up.
Oh, you're
up.
So much better than everybody. No, I'm kidding.
but I sleep for 2 hours, almost like a clock, and I'm awake, and then I don't go back to sleep. I guess my anxiety is beginning to extend because I hear so much about I'm supposed to have 7 or 8 hours sleep, and I'm wondering about zones, or you talk about blocks. It almost feels like macular degeneration where the center goes, and I sleep so well at the beginning, and then maybe at 4, 5, I go back to sleep for a little bit, but I get up at 6, so, you know, I'm up then. Now, sometimes I know that I'm worrying, but sometimes I'm not, and yet the pattern remains. And yet I function during the day. I seem to be okay, and I keep saying to myself, maybe I'm not okay because everything says I should be sleeping longer. And those 2 hours I know are very deep. I don't think I hear anything during those 2 hours. Could it be that that is enough sleep for me?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up with the 7-8 hours. I find that with patients with insomnia, they often focus on that. I need to get the 7 hours because so-and-so said so. What we know is that the majority of people need between 6 and 9 hours of sleep a night. So that's the majority of people to feel well-rested and refreshed during the next day. But there are people who are outliers who need less and some people who actually need a lot more than 8 or 9 hours a night. 2 hours is more on the extreme range, but you said also that you go back to sleep later on for a little while at 4, 5, 6 in the morning. So what might be something that you could think about also is how do you feel the next day? You said you're feeling okay during the next day, but if you're noticing that maybe you're having some memory issues or you're feeling fatigued at certain points, that's something to consider. And also, I don't know your exact sleep schedule history or anything, but maybe going to bed a little bit later, sometimes we find for some people going to bed later helps to push the awakening later, and then you might sleep a little later in the night.
Joan, thank you. Good luck. Are there different cognitive behavioral techniques for getting back to sleep than for originally getting to sleep?
I think that the things that work the best, one thing that's simple that many people do but does get in the way is looking at the clock. So everyone gets up in the middle of the night, they look at what the clock time is, and then they start doing the math. Oh, I've taken 4 hours to fall asleep, and now I finally fell asleep. Math does not help me get sleepy. I don't think it helps a lot of people get sleepy. So stop looking at the clock. And then what you were saying about what we were saying earlier about going to bed later, sometimes going to bed later can help push the awakening later, but you've got to keep the wake time the same 7 days a week. That's key.
Here's a related tip, I think, from a commenter on our website. Mm. Maria from Brooklyn writes that her brother told her that their dad told him, don't worry about falling asleep, just lying still and resting your body is good enough. And she says, when my mom scoffed at this and said my dad had given useless advice, my brother said, true or not, because he told me resting was good enough, I was able to stop worrying and sleep.
Ah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think it's like you were saying, the taking the worry out of it is what really helps a lot of people, even though we're constantly bombarded about you have to do this, you have to do this. Laying in bed, though, for long amounts of time and just resting is not, I mean, it feels better than just getting up and doing things, but laying in bed for prolonged amounts of time teaches your body that the bed is a place to lay awake and to think. So we actually prefer patients to get out of bed.
Really? That surprises me.
It's, you know, I think of a lot of cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia as being the anti-common sense treatment because we say, oh, we need to catch sleep when we can. But really, getting out of bed and going sitting somewhere else in dimly lit room and doing something to pass the time that's mildly pleasurable, like reading a magazine or listening to music or doing relaxation stretches, that is better than laying in bed because laying in bed just continues to teach yourself the bed's a place to worry and to lay awake.
And it's also counterintuitive, I think, to go to sleep later in order to get more sleep, the thing you said before, as opposed to if you're tired at 9:30, just go to sleep at 9:30. It's kind of weird for an insomniac to purposely keep themselves up for a couple more hours.
It is, and especially with patients that I have who have trouble falling asleep at night, when I give them the idea of saying, well, maybe we're going to go to bed at midnight or 1 in the morning, and they look at me like I have 3 heads, I say, well, what's your concern? They say, well, how am I ever going to stay up until 12 or 1? I look at them, and I say, well, you're cured.
Problem solved, yeah. Yep. Dion in Mount Vernon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dion.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for calling.
I have 2 points that I'd like to make. One, the first thing, I think it is mainly cultural. And secondly, I'll tell you how I deal with my culture shock and how I force myself to sleep. I'm a Jamaican. When I used to live in Jamaica, I had no problem sleeping because, one, the conditions were conducive to sleep when you want to sleep, and that is usually at night. Now that I've relocated to the United States, and in particular New York, what I notice is that my preoccupation with just about everything has soared significantly. I'm overwhelmed with a whole lot of things that I call unnecessary. And in my home situation, there is so much inundation of information passing right, left, and center. There's a radio and a television on in every single room. And what that does is that I get so overwhelmed with a whole lot of information that I'm processing that by the time I go to sleep, I think I am processing all of these things, thinking about all my day, and I get all excited again lying in bed, so I can't sleep. But in Jamaica, that wasn't the case. When it is bedtime, I did not have a television in my room. When it was bedtime, it was bedtime. When it was sleep time, it was sleep time. And I would usually go to bed by 10:30 the latest. Here, I'm going to bed at 2.
So, Dion,
so what do I do?
Dion has stepped into our wired, technologically overexposed world in the New York area, it sounds like.
Very much so.
Yes, and there are lots of sirens. Everywhere you go, there are sirens. There's horn tooting. There are so many, many sounds. That's too many sounds, a cacophony of sounds everywhere that you go. So you're always constantly alert.
Dion, hang on a second, because my producer wants to ask you a question off the air. But first, let's give Dion some advice. And that culture shock, I wonder how many immigrants to New York, whether they're from other countries or whether they're from central Iowa somewhere, have the same experience.
This is something my main practice is at Montefiore Medical Center, and this is something I hear all the time. When I lived so-and-so other place, this was never a problem until I came to New York City. I think the big thing we have to think about, which Deanna just mentioned, is she doesn't really get to process her day until right before it's time to go to bed. And sleep is not an on-off switch, although we'd like it to be because there's not enough time in the day. You really need to allow for a good half hour, ideally an hour, to let your brain decompress, and ideally without screens, to really let your brain know that the end of the day is coming near. And at the beginning of that hour, that's when you want to maybe – some patients actually benefit from journaling. Just think about your day and process it at that point, because if you try to process it right before bed, there's no way your brain's going to shut off.
But let me play devil's advocate here. If I'm journaling before going to sleep, then I might be thinking about all the issues in my day, which might keep me up.
Right.
If I turn on the television and put on some mindless old sitcom rerun or something, maybe I'm going to fall asleep.
Right. I think the screen can be a tricky issue. If you're someone who has trouble falling asleep and you're very alert at night, the screen isn't always ideal. It is something that can then take your mind off of things. But if it's really not helping, there are things like actually you can buy blue blocker glasses, things like that you can wear so you can watch TV if it's a mindless episode to help.
Jim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. You use some kind of media to go to sleep? Jim? Jim. All right. We'll try to get back to Jim. See, I tried to make such a perfect segue with what Jim had told our screener, but he wasn't there. I want to ask you about white noise.
Sure.
White noise, they say, has helped lots of babies stay asleep while the rest of the family is still awake and making noise. And a lot of people, grown-ups, swear the white noise machines help them fall asleep. There are sounds available. We're going to play some sounds.
Great.
Okay. From a particular white noise machine. It's the Conair SU1W sound therapy machine. This is not to recommend it or say that there are other ones that are worse or better. But it's the number one seller on Amazon, available for $19.99 with free shipping, they say. Did anyone out there – all right. So let's – we're going to play some different sounds from this machine right now. Okay, the first one is what they call bird song. Now I know why they call it bird song.
Calming.
Heartbeat. Babbling brook. That's too loud for me. I think it's going to come over the shore and flood my tent. The next one is waves. And finally, the one that the SU1W sound therapy machine just calls white noise. What makes this noise white?
Oh, gosh. I mean, what I like about this noise is there is no – it's just very constant. There is nothing else coming in. So when you're thinking about the other things we listen to, the wave, the heartbeat, the bird, there are little it's not constant. There's little noises here and there, different.
There's a lot of bass here.
Yeah, exactly. I actually, in all honesty, I use a white noise machine to sleep at night, and
I love it.
I started using it about 6 months ago, and it drowns out any outside noise for me. And I wouldn't say I need it to go to sleep, but it's definitely something missing that I can hear outside noises even more when I don't have it on. I love it.
Is it the nature of the noise itself is conducive to sleep, or that it blocks out other noises that are more coming and going?
I think it's a mix. I think the constant noise itself is what can help lull some people to sleep. But I think the bigger thing, especially here in New York City, is there are a lot of noises outside. And if you have a white noise machine, it can help. Now, that being said, there was a controversial or a study that came out recently that looked at white noise with babies and said that some people are using these machines way too loud, that it's actually hurting the hearing on some young children. There's nothing like that for adults, though. So I usually will keep my white noise machine outside by the door, and it's pretty good at blocking noise if that is an issue for you.
It's our family meeting on sleep on the Brian Lehrer Show. Join our Clock Your Sleep project at wnyc.org/sleep. That'll be going on through the month of April. My guest, Dr. Shelby Harris, the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at Montefiore Medical Center, and Amy in Harrington Park. You're on WNYC. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. I discovered a way to get back to sleep when I was pregnant 19 years ago. When I would wake up to go to the bathroom, as all pregnant women do, I found that if I could just keep any image or memory from a dream that I was having, when I got back into bed, if I could, you know, like a color, an image, anything, I would go right back to sleep. And I find that continues to work for me.
I think that's a great technique to use, and that's something I use, something similar to a lot of my patients, that it's that focused cognitive task that is not very exciting, but at least takes your mind off of anything else that can really help to bring sleep on.
Amy, thank you. Yes, pregnant women and middle-aged men all wake up to pee.
Oh, yes, very common. And women going through menopause, too. Huh. It's very common then.
Raj in Basking Ridge, you're on WNYC. Hey, Raj.
Hi, Brian. Great show. I'm a long-time listener.
Thank you.
Quick question about sleep. How does sex help sleep? And also, if I'm doing it, like some days if I don't, then I'm afraid that I shouldn't be using this as a way to get more sleep.
Well, are you saying that your experience is that if you have sex, then you sleep better?
Yes.
Is it best to do that for you just before going to sleep?
Yes.
I think there's a variety. I've seen both happen. I've seen a lot of patients who say that sex is a stress reliever for them, and they find that that actually helps them go to sleep. Other people, though, on the opposite, have the opposite reaction. They find it's too alerting. So then we have to recommend that you have sex earlier in the day, because if it's really going to be alerting, then you probably shouldn't be doing it before bedtime.
Note from the doctor, sex can be arousing.
There you go.
We figured that out. What's your approach to medication? Because I know you're a behavioral cognitive therapist, so obviously we've been focusing on that. But when do you tell your patients to start on it? Or do they all come to you after Ambien or some such thing and the natural melatonin and whatever other, you know, health food store stuff have already failed them?
Right. The ideal, really, and I like to go by the sleep medicine guidelines, is to really try to do CBTI if possible. And there's nothing else that's really going to get in the way of being able to do it.
CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy without drugs.
Yep. We try to do that first. It's ideal so you're not having to use medication. If you're not responding in 4 to 5 sessions, then we do go the medication route. That being said, I'm at a sleep center, and people don't come to a sleep center right off the bat. So the majority of people I see at the sleep center have gone to their primary care doctor, have tried everything under the sun, nothing works, so then they end up with me. I normally see people who are on meds, but they don't work as great as they'd like, or they'd like to get off them. That's when they usually come to me.
How about alcohol? I know somebody who says alcohol is definitely a sleep aid.
Alcohol does make you sleepy. That's why a lot of people will use it. They'll have that glass of wine or whatever before bed. The problem with alcohol is it makes the quality of your sleep really poor. So people might have more awakenings at night, or they'll just not feel as refreshed in the morning. So it's actually a really terrible sleep aid to use throughout the night.
Why does it make the quality of your sleep poor?
It wears off. So it wears off. So your body then basically wakes up craving more alcohol. And we all know that that is not a good technique to get into to sleep.
Darlene in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Darlene.
Hi, two things. One, and I don't think anybody has mentioned these, and yes, I stay awake, I wake up, but before I go to bed, if I can take a hot bath, and they're old news, not to wash, but literally just to soak in a hot bathtub, I find I'm falling asleep. And when I go to sleep, if I now wear the blindfold over the eyes, which, you know, I used to laugh about on I Love Lucy, I think she wore them, I find that when I wake up, yeah, I have to go to the bathroom, but once I go back to bed, if my eyes, if I don't see the light and somehow the blindfolds keep it darker, I am able to go back to sleep faster, to the point where if I don't have those, I really don't. I sleep worse than if I did have them. So I just wanted to put those two suggestions out there. They're inexpensive, they're cheap, and they really do work for me.
Darlene, thank you. And you know you live in Brooklyn when you have to wear a blindfold to keep out the light at night.
Right. I think the interesting thing that she also brought up was the hot baths. So there was a number of studies done in Japan a while ago that actually looked at people who took hot 20-minute hot baths about an hour and a half to 2 hours before bedtime. And that has been shown to help induce sleep. It has to do with our body temperatures and circadian rhythms, but it can help. Right before bed, for most people, can actually make your mind calm, but it can be physically too alerting. But an hour and a half before bed is really very beneficial for people.
Deborah in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Oh, hey, hello. There is a third leg to this three-legged stool you all have not introduced yet. We've done the medical, the overt medical, you know, the sleep apnea and the obesity. Now we're doing the behavioral and the cognitive.
Right.
But you've not gotten to the matter of more recent, of recent science paralleling this in the 90s of sleep clocks. Sleep clocks are a vital issue in resetting sleep that has not been factored in or presented now. And I know about this personally over a lifetime. That in when I was 12, I apparently had the disruption of a sleep clock that made it very difficult until the late 90s, we're talking from the 60s to the 90s, to have any kind of regulated sleep.
What do you mean by sleep clock?
Well, this is, I didn't know what it was, but let me explain the symptom, then you'll understand what the issue is.
Okay.
I couldn't fall asleep, and then when I fell asleep, I could not wake up. And since I lived such a high-performance, high-functioning life, that was devastating. And so you would have the cart put before the horse. Well, you can't sleep because you have these psychological issues. So let's figure out the issues and the behavior, and then you can sleep. So I spent decades doing that. It didn't work until I had a primary in the 90s, a primary physician who read an article about maybe disrupted sleep clock. And so she gave me 25 milligrams of amitriptyline beginning in the late 90s. And within 2 years, I was sleeping normally for the first time by 2001. I don't even take the med anymore. I can go to sleep whenever I want. I can wake up wherever I want. This did not happen until the sleep clock was identified. And yes, I dealt with issues of depression because I couldn't do the work I wanted to do. Mm.
And does the depression come from the lack of sleep, or does the lack of sleep come from
chicken
the depression?
Right.
But what about this idea of a sleep clock? Are you familiar with
yes.
that concept?
So what I think the caller is referring to are circadian rhythms. So that's that 24-hour kind of clock that's built into our body that tells us when to go to sleep and when to wake up. Now, what a lot of people have is what it sounds like she might have had was a delayed sleep phase issue, meaning that people with that problem can get a full night's sleep, but it's not on the timing that you would ideally like. So if you want to go to bed at 11 o'clock, this person or someone else might not be able to actually fall asleep until 4 or 5 in the morning and then sleep until 1. But as we know, many people need to be up much earlier than that to start their day. So there are different treatments. They're somewhat different from insomnia that can be used to reset sleep clocks or your circadian rhythm for these problems. And they can be very effective.
Deborah, thank you and good luck. It's our family meeting on sleep. All right. Who out there works the night shift? Evenings, overnights, anything you would call the night shift. We're going to clear the board of all other callers, and we're going to take your stories and questions for Shelby Harris now about working nights and sleep. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, the night shift and your sleep coming up in a minute.
Tonight I'll squeeze into heaven.
Yeah, we're going to talk about all you day sleepers now, or at least you hope to be sleeping during the day if you're working the night shift. It's our family meeting on sleep here on The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. And if you work nights, you know, I know you're there. Let me just say that. So many people tell me I work nights, so I wake up to your late morning show. So let's hear your stories of how you sleep after the night shift and what you do about it. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And people, this is an area I know well. Doing radio, a 24/7 operation, I have started work at almost every hour of the day at one time or another. I did overnights for about 5 years. I could tell you, Dr. Harris, not just about overnight shifts, but which overnight shifts. So like when I worked 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., mm-hmm. my evenings were clipped because I had to go to work at 9:30, but I would come home at 6:30 and boom, sleep.
Right.
And I actually felt like I was putting one over on the world, working when it was quiet and the suits weren't around, then sleeping through most of the rat race mm-hmm. hours. But when my overnight shift was 1 a.m. to 9 a.m., that was horrible for me. By that time of morning, the world was buzzing way too much, more cars and general street noise out my Greenwich Village window, too much light, light was an issue, and it was harder to get to sleep. So one overnight shift was not the same as the next. And the worst for me was working a radio morning shift. One of mine was 4:30 to 12:30, 4:30 a.m. to 12:30 just afternoon, and that was the pits. When would I sleep? My game plan was to split my sleep, try to get 4 hours after work, about 2 to 6 in the afternoon, try to have a regular evening with my friends, then sleep again from about 11 to 3. But it never really worked. I couldn't sleep well in either shift. I was always strung out.
Right.
And I quit that morning show after just 6 weeks to take a lower paying job precisely because of sleep.
Curative.
So those are a few of my night shift stories. Listeners, let's hear yours. And you can also get some night shift sleeping advice from our guest, Shelby Harris, 212-433-9692. Was that smile on your face the smile of familiar recognition when I was telling my story?
Very familiar. You know, about 30% of people who work night shift actually have trouble with insomnia when they want to sleep. And then when they go to sleep or they're going to work at night, they're excessively sleepy. So what you said about how I'm trying to break it up into two shifts, that's a very common strategy a lot of people try. Some people, though, just really are not meant to, I hate to say it, they're not meant to work the night shift or any sort of shift work. Their bodies just don't adjust to it as well as other people.
We had a guest earlier who was talking about some olden days concept of second sleep.
Right.
Like when there was no electricity and people used to go to sleep when the sun went down, sleep for 4 hours, wake up, chat and read and stuff for a couple of hours in the middle of the night, if they had reading yet in those days.
Right.
And then they went back to sleep for a few hours when the sun came up. Was that ever really a thing?
Yeah, there's more and more people talking about it, and it's very likely that it was a thing that people were doing. However, in today's society, it's not really so practical. So it's really about trying to fit in what you can do and try and sleep as much as possible.
That's different from the siesta model.
Yes.
Where you sleep in the afternoon a little bit in the hot climates.
Right.
But that second shift sleep model, which I only read about for the first time yesterday, surprises me and makes me wonder if it was ever real, because if that second sleep is at sunrise, it just seems like a wake-up time, and
right.
our biology wouldn't be compatible with it.
Right. It's something that a lot of the anthropology area is kind of looking at more and more. In the sleep field, we haven't really adopted it so much as a typical recommendation. However, when it comes to people who have shift work disorder, they're working shifts, sometimes that's the only thing you can do is to break it up into two shifts to be able to get through the day.
All right, shift workers, 212-433-WNYC. When people finish up, because our lines are full now, Barbara in Columbia, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Barbara.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
Hi.
So you're
a
nurse?
I've been a critical care nurse for 24 years, always nights, and I'm blessed in that I rarely work more than two nights in a row. But my difference is the days that I'm off, I don't go to sleep, and I'll typically be up between 36 and 40 hours before I do go to bed.
Mm.
So I think I function well, but I think my family would disagree.
Right. It's hard also figuring out, because I don't know your exact sleep schedule, but what most people end up trying to do is if you work two nights, you're up all night, and then people, when they're off, they try to actually revert to their normal sleep schedule or a normal sleep schedule and sleep at night. And it's that abrupt shifting between sleeping at night, sleeping during the day, that can really throw off your clock, that people really don't – their bodies don't know how to adjust to it. So sometimes on the days off, coming up with a compromise, so maybe not going to bed at a quote-unquote normal nighttime, say 11 or 12, but maybe doing it later – so maybe 3 or 4 in the morning, to compromise between the night shift and the time that you have off, that can be a little bit more gentler for people's systems to handle.
Barbara, hang on. My producer wants to ask you a question off the air. And which do you think is worse, Dr. Harris, being a night shift nurse for 24 years in a row on the same schedule like Barbara, or what I think a lot of cops do, which is get rotated through the three shifts, a few weeks 4 to 12, a few weeks 12 to 8, a few weeks 8 to 4.
Right.
Which is worse for you,
either? Consistency is key when you're doing some sort of shift work. So working the night shift, if you're someone who adapts to it okay and it's not creating insomnia during the day, that's actually better. The rotating shift schedule is an interesting one, in that if we think about our body clocks and the circadian rhythm, they actually are a little longer than 24 hours. So if you ever think about it, it's easier to stay up later than it is to force yourself to go to sleep earlier. So if you're working a rotating shift, and I know this is not always possible, we actually recommend people to rotate in a clockwise fashion. So maybe a week at the day shift, then a week at the evening shift, then a week overnight, and then you go back to the day, as opposed to jumping back and forth. It's a jumping back and forth and inconsistent schedules. That's the hardest thing to adapt to.
Jeffrey on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay.
Hi. Yes, I work the midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning. And usually I get home around 9 in the morning, and I'm up for a couple of hours, an hour or two, then I go to sleep. And then depending on my daughter's schedule, I'll have to wake up and then go and be with her and do things with activities for a few hours. And then usually make dinner, things of that nature, and then I go back to sleep and sleep another 3 to 4 possibly hours, usually about 3 hours, and then I get up and prepare myself to go back to work.
That's a real, I mean, if it's working for you, then great. And that's, I'm happy that it sounds like it's working for you. And that's the kind of example of usually breaking up your sleep into two chunks so that it fits into your life, because the rest of the world tends to go on during the day. That if you have to do it, but you're sleeping okay, then keep doing it.
And it's just easy for you to fall asleep because you're tired each time you come to a sleep period?
Well, it varies. Oh. Sometimes I will just pass out, and that I like that. Other times I can't, so I might have a beverage, like maybe one beer or something.
Okay. So the one thing I would recommend, though, is in the few hours in the middle, when you're up and you're doing things with your daughter, to try to wear sunglasses, or try to not get too much light exposure, because the more light exposure that you're getting, and the more that's going to make you more alert. So it makes the second sleep period harder to come by. So if you can try on the days off to get it all at once when you don't have to get up and do things, that would be great. Otherwise, break it up and try not to get so much light.
Jeffrey, good luck. A previous caller had mentioned a blindfold.
Yes.
Good for people trying to sleep in the day?
Excellent. You have to try and get rid of all disturbances. So people, you know, if you have people who keep calling you or texting you in the middle of the day, tell them that this is your time that you're sleeping, because you're not going to call them at 3 in the morning.
Mike in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I work for a state law enforcement agency, and the single biggest source of stress for me personally is irregular hours. And when I interact with other law enforcement agencies, including the NYPD and especially the New York City Department of Corrections, they often work something called the wheel, where every 2 weeks their shift is pushed back 7 hours. And I see a direct correlate between burnout and aggression and being sleep-deprived. And everywhere I look, I see sleep-deprived people, and I see with my peers and my colleagues, and I see it very, very much related to having short fuses and just being aggressive in general.
Right. I think that's an important point, is that when people have work shift work, and not everyone who works shift work has issues with it, but a large percentage of that population does have issues. So the people who do have issue, we find that shift work can actually create more irritability, can create more depression, and overall poor quality of life and health issues, too. We've seen that it really is linked to cardiovascular issues, and there's been some research looking at it linking to cancer. So working irregular shifts can really have a major impact on your life. life if it's causing problems for you.
Mike, I'm curious if the union, I assume you're in a union position, hasn't taken up this as a point of negotiation to getting off that, you know, move it back 7 hours sleep wheel.
My union isn't on that, doesn't have that schedule, or my work doesn't have a, doesn't work a wheel, but it's still very, very volatile irregular hours. And forgive my cynicism, but public unions have been absolutely neutralized for since Governor Pataki. I mean, we've only lost and lost again and had more concessions in our what we have. It's the source of stress is the work environment that isn't necessary. It doesn't need to be that way. And yet we just have no voice. We're just not effective.
Interesting. Mike, thank you. And I have heard also that sometimes the union members like it because some of those shifts that are at night come with certain kinds of overtime or bonus pay.
Right.
And so they like to rotate onto them as well as they rotate off to them. So I don't know what all the politics of it really are.
I think there are some people who actually really like it that way. But the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that we do – there have been major catastrophes that have happened because of shift work and sleep deprivation and things like that. And then the company or whoever is involved in it will take some steps to – and then it's all in the media and they'll say, okay, we're now – allowing for this person to get 8 hours, but it's not always enough. And so there's a lot of press about it for a few days, but then kind of old habits come back and then, you know, sleep deprivation happens again.
Kevin and Mike, hold on because our producer wants to talk to you off the air. And Kevin in Bridgeport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Brian. I'm a musician, and so I have to be up playing. And I don't get to bed until usually 3 o'clock in the morning, 2, 3, sometimes 4 if I'm driving back from the city. And it's tricky because, you know, I'm tired when I'm driving home and then I get home and I'm like wide awake and I'm wired. So then I might turn on TV or eat something because I'm hungry because I was performing and then I can't fall asleep for another hour or so. And then I'm sleeping until 11 o'clock or, you know, later. But if I get up earlier, then I have a problem later at night. And it also is tough on relationships because, you know, you're on this opposite schedule. And then on nights when I'm not working, I'm trying to go to bed early. But then when I have to work, I'm falling asleep driving home. So it's definitely tricky. And the thing of coming home, I try not to eat, even though I'm hungry, and I want to watch TV to unwind because I find that just wakes me up for another hour or so and just makes it harder.
Yeah, it sounds complicated. And you know what? Nobody else has brought up food until now. Is there a time to eat and not to eat if sleep is your issue?
Right. If you think about it, if this is someone as a musician, I don't know how many nights a week you're working necessarily, but nighttime is a time when our body is not supposed to be eating, right? So if you're getting home and it's really late or very, very early in the morning, your body's not meant to be having food at that time. So you're giving it a signal that it's daytime. So that's really getting in the way of sleep coming. And the other thing is you have to think about light exposure a lot, which we talked about a few minutes ago. When you're driving home, if the sun is starting to come up at that point, right, that's going to be alerting. So you really need to think about trying to take a nap before going to work, using caffeine for the first few hours of being at work, and trying to limit food the rest of the night, and then really limit light within the last 2 hours of your shift when you're about to go home. But it's tough when you're a musician because we like people to get a lot of light at the beginning of the shift. But when you're working in a club or wherever, you're not always able to get that.
Kevin, thank you and good luck. He mentioned not being able to have a social life because he works nights. When I worked evenings, I talked before about my various overnight and early morning shifts before. When I worked evenings, I found that was the most conducive to sleep and being really well rested. My evening shift was usually 5 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Right.
And I would come home afterwards and wind down, then sleep from around 3 a.m. until 10 or 11 or noon. And I felt like I could sleep in every day and wake up without an alarm and still have plenty of business hours left to take care of stuff if I needed to. And then I went to work. The downside was that was a lonely man shift. I was working in the evening when everyone else I knew was off, and I was off when they were working. So I saw a lot of weekday matinees and empty movie theaters, and I wish there were midday singles events. But for the purpose of sleep, nirvana.
Right. I mean, I think that's a later shift, but 3 a.m., 2 a.m. to go to bed is not super drastic. You're not going to bed at 7, 8 when the sun's already out. So it can be a little easier to adjust to, but I get the social aspect. You know, everyone else is not around when you want to sleep or go out.
Valerie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Val.
Oh, what a pleasure. Good morning, Brian. I love your show.
Thank you.
I listen to it faithfully. I was a TV news producer for a little over 40 years, the last 21 of which I did shift work, and I did every shift, the overnight, the evening, the days, all mixed up. And it could happen that I would work until 2 o'clock in the morning, and then the next day I would have to be at work at 9 a.m. So as a result, I think, I cannot sleep more than 2 hours at a time, no matter what. And I have a totally broken sleep pattern. I enjoyed my work. I loved my work. And I functioned very well on any shift.
And let me get you an answer, Val. Forgive me. I'm sure as a former TV news producer, you understand that we are slaves to the clock. So quickly, the story is she was on this mandatory schedule because of work for all those decades. Now she's off it. But her body can't get off it.
Right, her circadian rhythm is all mixed up. So sometimes that's a good example of maybe consulting with a sleep specialist who can get you on a better sleep schedule and kind of track your sleep for a few weeks to really see if there's any pattern that's emerging at all. And that's when really thinking about light therapy to keep you up at certain times, and maybe sometimes sedating medications can help to really get a bigger chunk.
And that, people, is our Brian Lehrer Show family meeting.
Thank you.
On sleep. We thank Dr. Shelby Harris, the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at Montefiore Medical Center. This family meeting was part of WNYC's sleep project called Clock Your Sleep. Go to wnyc.org/sleep to learn how to track your own sleep online or with our new app, which you can get for free from the iTunes store, and find out how your sleep compares to everyone else. Dr. Harris, thank you so much for being an advisor to the project.
Thank you.
And we will be doing sleep cycles through the life cycle on Wednesdays all month here on the show, beginning next week with baby and parent sleep a week from today. And we'll be back tomorrow with other stuff. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Forklift.